Monster Man, bonus episode, August 2022.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a bonus episode, going out to all my patrons at all levels as a thank you for your continued support. In these bonus episodes, I talk about what I've been up to over the past month, and they don't really have a structure. This month has been a month of catching up, as you can tell from the fact that this August episode is going out to you in early September, and not the middle of the month, which has been the case with some of the previous ones. It's been a quiet month. It's been a month of getting back to work in some fields. The beginning of the school year is approaching, which means that my tutoring is picking up. Someone asked me what I did for a living at a party, and I had to describe it as, oops, all side hustles, which is not inaccurate. But tutoring is one of them, and I had my first session yesterday as I'm recording this. And by the end of next week, I'll have a couple of regular students on the go. Anyway, I have had time to do some reading. I finished For Honor and Fame, that book that I started, which was about the culture of chivalry in medieval England. I wasn't convinced by its account of the early Middle Ages, but in terms of kind of the culture and literature and sort of the interaction of literature and politics of chivalry in the high and late Middle Ages, I found it a bit more persuasive. It interests me because ideals like chivalry are all about the complex relationships that people have with their own ideals and aesthetics. So people believe in a set of principles, even if they don't necessarily carry those principles out in real life. So an obvious example would be something like religion, right? Most religions have some kind of code of behavior that most of their followers do not follow all the time. Maybe they try to, maybe they don't try to, but they respect those virtues and they have feelings about them, even though they don't necessarily carry them out. And I don't know that that necessarily makes them hypocrites any more than people who subscribed to the ideals of chivalry but actually were ruthless scumbags are hypocrites. I think those relationships are more complicated than that. Those ideals and those images still have the power to move people, but that doesn't mean that there's some kind of computer program that those people just follow all the time. And I think that this is something that's often missing in role-playing games, with the exception of things like Pendragon, right? So Pendragon is all about the conflicts that your values create. And to me, that's very interesting. But to a lot of people, they are taken as like a justification for a particular course of action. And the idea is that a well role-played character is one who predictably behaves according to a set of iron laws, rather than a human who has an ongoing relationship with a set of principles and interprets those in various ways, leading to different actions. So I thought that was interesting. I also read the Stargrave supplement, The Last Prospector. I'd love to run that campaign. I've lost my regular Stargrave opponent who moved to France. This sort of leads me to one of my miniatures gaming problems, which is that given how sort of odd, I say odd, right? There are big communities that play these games, but I just don't seem to be able to regularly get to a club that is into those things. I kind of have to organize it myself, which is not really my strong suit. And this, more than anything else, has sort of made me understand why people play Warhammer. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with Warhammer, but what I mean is you can pop on the Facebook group for your local gaming club and say, I want to play Warhammer, this many points, this army, and someone else will pop up and say, absolutely, let's play. Which is a lot more accessible than what's going to happen if I say, I want to play Space Station Zero, which is, I'm going to have to explain what that is, and I'm going to have to teach the other people how to play the game. I mean, I don't have it. I just picked that name as a game that I've been thinking about buying lately. But, you know, I'm going to have to teach them what the game is, and then I'm going to have to wait forever while they paint their force, and then by the time that they're done, I'm going to have lost interest. That actually happened to me with Saga. I stopped caring about the game before my opponent was finished painting their army. Fortunately, it's a historical game, so you can use the same figures for other games, but you know what I mean. So I'd love to run the Last Prospector campaign. I think it's got interesting mechanics for like building up clues along the investigation, very clearly sort of inspired by the maps in Frostgrave Ghost Archipelago. I also finished Unfortunate Ends, which is the book based on Murdered by Clarks. If you followed Murdered by Clarks on Twitter, it was a project that was based on death records in medieval England, specifically the records of coroner's inquests, which happened when people died by misadventure or by foul play. And it's a great kind of fascinating slice of life look at sort of a dark side of English history. It's quite short. I don't know that it's worth the like £11 price tag on the physical book, but if you find it for cheap, I think it's definitely worth giving it a read. I backed it on Unbound years and years and years ago, which, you know, was a nice little present from past me to present me. I was just kind of minding my own business, and this book showed up. It's like, oh yeah, I paid for this. But it's pretty short, so I started it yesterday and finished it today. And it is kind of, you know, I think if you play a game set in a more or less historical Middle Ages, it is a very interesting look at sort of the legal processes surrounding violence and the ways in which justice and revenge work in a society that has a legal system but doesn't have, like, police. And the small things that can lead to violence, which are more or less what sort of can lead to violence in the modern day. There's quite a lot of drunken arguments that get out of control in the book. Anyway, I thought it was quite interesting. Not essential, but fun. I also started reading Ian Morris's book, Geography is Destiny, which is a kind of deep history of Britain's relationship to Europe. I don't feel like I'm so far into it that I necessarily have much to say. One of the things that I think is really worthwhile is the stuff about like the changing landscapes of the Ice Ages. You know, I'm not a prehistorian. I don't know very much about this kind of like early human stuff. So it's always worthwhile for me to be reminded that there isn't like a period called the Ice Age and then the ice melts. It's actually a constantly changing, you know, climate and environment, and one in which the timescales are huge. So there's a brief period where cooling global temperature makes Britain uninhabitable again, and indeed pretty much all of Northern Europe. And by brief, I mean it's over 1,000 years. You know, that kind of thing. Viewing, let's see, I it's almost hard for me to remember what I watched in which month. I'm pretty sure that I watched Prey since my last episode. Prey has been the subject of a lot of discussion and kind of geek worlds. It is the most recent film in the Predator franchise, which makes it the 6th movie, I think. Predator, Predator 2, Alien vs. Predator, Alien vs. Predator Requiem, The Predator, Predators, Prey. Okay, it's 7 films, and it's actually the other way around. It goes Predators and then The Predator. Could someone just make a rule that films and video games have to be numbered? Predators 1-7, thank you very much. I mean, I'll give you a pass for Alien vs. Predator, because it would be best if those films were forgotten. Which you could save some other Predator films as well. Now, I have quite a soft spot for Predator 2. It's something that I think is comparatively quite rare today, but actually something that you see in the franchise genre pictures of the 80s. First Blood and Rambo, Alien and Aliens, Predator and Predator 2, Terminator and Terminator 2, the original film and its sequel are radically different from each other. Anyway, Prey, it's very good. I knew Amber Midthunder from Legion. She's very good in it. It struck me that Prey does a narrative structure that role-playing games really struggle to emulate, because it is essentially a series of defeats for the protagonist. But from each of these defeats, or each of these, like, horrific experiences, she gains a necessary, like, clue or piece of information that she eventually uses to defeat the threat. So her triumph comes at, like, her darkest hour, right? That the moment where you think, well, wait, I mean, you don't think, because you know how these movies go, but where a person in the universe would think, wow, she's in real trouble. She manages to piece all of the things that she's learned together to defeat the creature. The internet, like, quote-unquote controversy about this, in which people are, like, calling the character a Mary Sue or whatever, is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, yes, no kidding, correct, you have identified that the protagonists of action movies are not realistic characters. Did you think that, like, Dutch Schaefer was a realistic character just because he's a man? You know what I mean? Like, oh, she's just a wish fulfillment character. Right. Whereas Dutch Schaefer is a grimly realistic portrayal of the stresses of a special forces soldier's life. Get a grip. But so I was talking a while back with a friend of mine about how to achieve this kind of thing in RPGs. And I'm sure there are those which use this structure, right? I mean, this is a little bit maybe like, well, kind of the reverse of how momentum works in 2D20, right? Like momentum is something that you get when you succeed at things, right? The idea that like, well, it's momentum, right? Things are starting to go your way. But I almost feel like, I know there are games that have comeback mechanics, but it sort of surprises me that there aren't more. I also watch Day Shift, which is on Netflix, which is a, you know, action comedy. It's fine. It's one of those games. I think this is something they say a lot on the Grognard Files, this idea that bad movies make good gaming, because the premise of that movie is a fun idea for a game about like hardworking union member vampire hunters. But the actual like comedy of it, like the kind of like badinage, is substantially Marvel Comics comedy, where these people are kind of like gesturing at the shape of a type of humor that they know exists, but this is actually not that. Like, it's meant to be a classic buddy cop formula about like the loose cannon and the like by the book guy, but it's just not actually funny or good. It has some good set pieces, like the vampire fights are fun. And, you know, Jamie Foxx, a charismatic leading man, but he's not getting to do what he does well in this movie. But the idea is fun. I'd run that game. I'd run that game a lot sooner than I watch that movie again. I wish I could talk to, I guess, anybody about Wu-Tang and American Saga, which had a second season, and which I actually think I watched at least some of before the last episode, but I don't know if I talked about it. And I was thinking about why this is, right? There's just not that many other people that I know that are into, and I'm not even that into the hip-hop of the 90s, but it was such like a pervasive cultural influence at that time. You know, I remember someone coming into, I was at like one of those summer school program things. I went off to satisfy my economics requirement at one of those summer schools where, you know, you stay for a couple of weeks at a university campus and it's meant to give you a taste of college life, but I was actually too close to home for that to really work. So I still like spent all the evenings, instead of hanging out with my new friends from all around the world, I went and like played games with my pals. So that wasn't great. I shouldn't have done that. But anyway, I mean, we had a good time, so I guess it doesn't make a difference. But I remember a girl who was, like, on the same floor as me, you know, coming into the room that I shared with these two other guys, or the little, like, apartment, I guess, that I shared with these two other guys to show us Enter the Wu-Tang 36 Chambers. Which, though, if I have my calculations right, must have been out for at least a year by that point. But I'd never heard of it, you know. But they were pretty pervasive in the late 90s and early 2000s. And, you know, I think what's interesting to me about the Wu-Tang Clan is that the whole kind of Wu-Tang aesthetic, in many ways, is similar to what I like about the worlds of early comic books and role-playing games and, you know, early Warhammer, right? It's just this melange of, like, things that these young men happen to find interesting, you know? And what that is varies a little bit, right? Because they're not all, you know, it's this different group of guys and they all have slightly different interests. But, you know, it's this imagery which has that sense of mysteriousness and of incompleteness. I think for everyone, for almost everyone, like, if you're not the RZA, there's probably some aspect of the Wu-Tang aesthetic which is enigmatic to you. Even if you're fully up on, like, kung fu movies and comic books, which are referenced extensively, you might not know that much about the teachings of the Nation of Gods and Earths, which are also an important influence on Wu-Tang lyrics. Or you might not know all that much about, like, fashion. There's a lot of stuff about clothing in Wu-Tang lyrics, right? I mean, even in a more, like, serious Wu-Tang track like Cream, Raekwon talks a lot about clothes, because Raekwon always talks a lot about clothes. But he's not alone. Half the time, if there's a reference in there you don't get, it's about drugs, and the other half of the time, it's about streetwear brands that were popular in the 90s. And that kind of idiolect, like, idiolect is not exactly the right word, but idiolect refers to the unique combination of speech patterns and vocabulary and whatever that every individual has, right? It's not a dialect, which is the speech of a group, the speech of an individual, that we all have, like, uniquely identifiable ways that we talk. These are our idiolects. At least that's the term as I understand it. I could be wrong. Linguists, let me know in the comments. But things like that always leave that sense of incompleteness, that sense of seeing the tip of the iceberg, right? So reading D&D with its, like, weird blend of Robert E. Howard and Fritz Leiber and, like, John Carter and a military history buff's grasp of medieval history. You know, the thing that strikes people as really weird in AD&D a lot of the time is all the like glaive, guisarme, voulges, right? And that's just the kind of thing that the sort of medieval history nerd who pours through like museum exhibition catalogs looking at different types of polearm, or, you know, reads a lot of Osprey books, you know, that kind of stuff is the sort of thing that interests them, and it winds up in the game. And then if what you like is, you know, dragons and magic spells, then you are a little confused by it because it's from outside your frame of reference. But everyone combines different frames of reference, and of course, like, individual creative impulses. It's interesting, you know, that D&D became the flashpoint of this controversy about, like, the occult and Satanism and whatever, because you can tell from the books that it's actually not something that particularly interests these people. You know, even though the 70s were definitely a time of like popular fascination with quote unquote the occult and quote unquote black magic, I don't think that any of D&D's creators were particularly into that kind of stuff. And what's interesting is that when games come out, people get their hands on them and they look at them through the lenses of their own particular overlapping areas of interest, right? So you can see that with RuneQuest, where you got one guy who looks at D&D and goes, that's not how sword fights work. And one guy who looks at it and goes, that's not how mythology and civilizations work. And put them together and you get a game where, you know, there's a lot of thinking about who exactly is the Lord of the Middle Air and how would you determine that? And then also about what happens when someone hits you in the knee with a bronze sword. Anyway, yeah, the weird thing, the weird combination of all the things that happen to be important to the RZA is incredibly compelling, at least to me. And that's maybe, you know, partly why Sandman didn't land with me to the same extent. Like, I watched that Netflix Sandman series and it was fine. I read the comics when they came out. Well, not when they came out, but a few years after that. And they were fine. Like, they're not bad. Sandman joins Babylon 5 as one of those things that I think is pretty good, but like I'm not that excited about, which makes me some kind of geek heretic, right? Like, from my thinking that Babylon 5 is okay, people think I hate it because most people love it so much. But it seemed to me to be a case where a lot of the like weird bits had been smoothed down a little bit, you know? I think Neil Gaiman is very good at appealing to an area where a lot of people's interests overlap. And maybe that means, and you know, maybe this is unfair for me, I'm not sure that this is true, maybe that means sanding down some of the areas that don't fit within that. But on the other hand, the RZA didn't do that, and he was hugely successful. So, who knows? Gaming. I ran my second Old School Essentials session. I don't think it went as well as the first, largely because I think, you know, there's something within the unstructured, well, highly structured and yet at the same time unstructured, the narratively unstructured mode of old school play that can produce these instances that are somewhat anticlimactic. So the gang got to the sort of big moment where they met this important NPC and they were actually able to just have a very simple and civil conversation with her because they had done all the things that they needed to do in order to get her on their side. Not as a plan, they had just done it, you know. It just had sort of worked out that way. Whereas if they'd met her early on, she might have been quite suspicious of them, or she might have sent them to do all those things. But as it happened, it's kind of like when you meet an NPC in a video game, and they give you a quest, and you're like, oh, I've actually already done this, and it just ticks off right away. So, and I think that that sort of anticlimax is something that you have to learn to mitigate a little bit if you're going to play in this way, and I think I could have zhuzhed it up a bit. My tendency is often to de-escalate, and I need to work against that. That is something that's a good idea in real life, but not fun in role-playing games. However, we do have a spin-off coming. At one point, if you, and this is a spoiler for a very early part of Winter's Daughter, the characters run into some droons who are basically kind of evil sorcerers, and they're about to sacrifice a young lady. But what they don't know is that she has agreed to this because she knows that her sacrifice is the only thing that will save her village from a lake monster called the Great Chook. And the PCs, not listening to any of this, defeated the droons through actually pretty clever. You know, the droons are very powerful spellcasters, so what you need to do whenever you have a powerful spellcaster is bum rush them. Because the way that spellcasting works in old school essentials, if you can crowd a wizard and just get in their face and hit them, they may not be able to cast their spell. But having done that, they're now rather concerned about the Great Chook rising from the lake, particularly as one of the players has chosen to settle in the area. And so it looks like our second scenario is going to be, you know, Knight of the Chook. So that's going to be fun. And I like the way in which that kind of spins off from this little detail in a scenario that's not really all that important. The announcement of the D&D 1 playtest, I think, has cemented for me that I'm, you know, my days of 5e are drawing to a close. I think this game that I'm running right now is going to be the last game I run using that system, which means that I've run two very long campaigns using it, plus a couple of smaller games. I don't think that's a problem, you know. I'm not wedded to whatever the current system of D&D is as my game of choice. It's just what I happened to run when a group of players got together and asked me to run a D&D game for my first campaign. Actually, I had never run Dungeons & Dragons before, though I'd played it. Tell a lie, I had actually run one session of Labyrinth Lord once. But same for this one. You know, I like positional combat. It's fun for me in role-playing games. I like the miniatures aspect. I like that visual aspect. So that appealed to me about 5e. But typically, I don't just play the same game over and over and over again. I don't think I'll ever lose, like, a general interest in fantasy gaming of that kind. But we may see that the next thing is something else. I mean, I'm going to keep running my OSC game for a while, certainly. But I think a game that I don't have to really put any effort into keeping up with is important to me. Because to me, that adds work without adding fun. And I think, yeah, like I say, I think they may be drawn to a close. That's not a criticism of any of the stuff in that playtest, which I haven't read, or of the game in general. It's just kind of how it goes for me. I have been playing a lot of Call of Cthulhu lately, and that is not a criticism on that game. But, you know, sometimes you find yourself in the mood for a particular thing, and sometimes you don't. And I keep getting this thought in my head that says, what is the old school, like, what is the OSC of superhero games? Is there a widely accepted simple superhero game? And I don't think there is. Maybe because so many superhero games have licensed properties attached to them, right? Like that they're Marvel games or whatever, but I don't know. If you've got a recommendation for a superhero game that's not like Champions, put it in the comments. I'd be interested to hear about it. All right, anyway, that's what I've been up to. My belated Rogue Trader campaign is finally getting started, so you'll probably hear some more about that in the next episode. But until then, all that remains is to thank you for listening, and thank you very much for your ongoing support of Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'll see you next time.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.